Up next, JX assistant producer Maddie Peterson offers a selection of short news features from around our region.
I'm Maddie Peterson. The Astoria Column, which was built in 1926 to celebrate settlement of the Pacific Northwest, celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. As OPB's Christian Fodenwenzel reports, it was supposed to be one of a dozen majestic monuments on a grand railway tour.
In the gift shop at the base of the Astoria Column, manager Meredith Barlow Spry stands over a big box of balsawood airplane parts.
This is our workstation here, so this is where we are building them. Any downtime we have.
While the column offers plenty of history and stunning views, for many visitors it's the airplanes they remember. Thanks to an anonymous benefactor, they're still just a dollar each, and visitors love to throw them off the top of the 125-foot column to see how far they can fly.
Little tip with the planes. So if you have the wings all the way to the back, that's going to be set for a longer flight. And then push the wings forward, does loops and tricks.
Astoria is planning all kinds of events for the anniversary, a heritage fair, a rededication ceremony, a lecture. Just about every month has some kind of nod. Chelsea Vaughan, the curator of the Clatsop County Historical Society, is setting up a new exhibit on the column and how it's decorated. Italian immigrant Attilio Postella coated the column in different colors of plaster, then etched away the layers to create an image. But they began to fade within just a few years of Oregon's horizontal rain.
Tung oil was applied to the exterior of the column, and that has the effect of physically darkening the column so that then accelerated the, loss of pictures in that way.
White latex paint was applied in the 1960s to Meriwether Lewis and William Clark.
The original lines weren't really followed, and somehow it was either Lewis or Clark gets mutton chops. Elvis was suddenly on the column.
Portland philanthropist Jordan Schnitzer created Friends of Astoria column in the 1990s after noticing the artwork was suffering. He helped raise more than $1 million to clean it, and in 1995, cover it in a special paint.
That is sort of like Gore-Tex. It lets the moisture out, but keeps the moisture from coming in.
He says standing on top of the column fills him with emotion.
If one is religious, I guess one could say you feel close to God being up there. If one is a humanist, one would feel that you are part of this cosmos.
In addition to honoring historic figures, the column highlights Astoria's role in the construction of the Northwestern Railways and the Astor family's businesses, which means for some, it's a symbol of colonialism and a testament to the displacement of Native Americans. But Tony Johnson, the chairman of the Chinook Indian Nation, says they're not too worried about misrepresentations.
Were we to do it again in 2026, we know that folks would approach it differently, and we would have a much more historically accurate depiction. But we are not losing sleep over that.
He says the Chinook Nation knows its own connection to the area, and things will change, hopefully for the better, over time.
I mean, the United States is a baby, right? Is very young. You know, America has to grow up still, right? It needs to mature.
The column is an impressive monument, but originally it was meant to be part of a much bigger vision. The president of the Great Northern Railroad in the 1920s dreamed of a grand railroad tour where people would stop across the Pacific Northwest to visit big monuments commemorating westward expansion. In researching the column, Chelsea Vaughan says they were supposed to be 12 monuments.
I was coming up short because there are not 12 monuments. There's not even close. Officially, there are 6 monuments, of which the Astoria Column is by far the most grand.
Other monuments that did get built include a granite orb, 5 feet in diameter in North Dakota, dedicated to explorer David Thompson, who helped map North America. There's also the Marias Pass Obelisk in Montana, dedicated to Theodore Roosevelt, and some less official monuments.
I actually went out and saw one the other day, and it looked vaguely like a gravestone in both size and shape.
climbing to the top of the 164 steps, Mac Burns with Friends of Astoria Column says locals don't generally see the column as some kind of monument to colonialism. Instead, it's a wonderful spot to stop and appreciate the world.
This is the perfect view of Astoria, how it's a peninsula. You can see the 8 miles out to the Pacific Ocean. You can see the 6 miles across the river to Washington State, our beautiful Astoria Megler Bridge.
You can climb to the top of the column for free. It's a city park, but parking does cost money. It's going up from $5 to $10 a year by May.
I'm Christian Fodenwenzel reporting.
The Roe River Valley is home to several rural, unincorporated communities east of Cottage Grove. Locals say the densely forested area is especially vulnerable to wildfire and other natural disasters. 2 years ago, in an effort to bolster their chances of surviving a catastrophe, the communities banded together to create their own fire district. KLCC's Rebecca Hansen-White has more on phase two of their efforts, getting their first fire station off the ground.
Gary Mowry says when a wildfire raged through neighboring farms in 2018, he used sprinklers to save his home.
When it got to my house, I had two sections with fencing, and the fire came within 3 feet of my fence.
Mowry lives near the unincorporated community of Dorena. In an interview from his backyard, he said help used to be at least 40 minutes away if neighboring communities had engines free. Mowry says he feels safer now that the new district's trained volunteers are just a few minutes down the road. He's hoping a permanent fire station will make response faster and more reliable.
It's something that's just very, very important. We've had a lot of fires. We've had a lot of homes burned to the ground because the equipment, if there was equipment coming, couldn't get here in time because we're too far out.
The Rao River Fire District covers about 500 homes surrounding Dorena Lake and stretching almost to the border of the Umpqua National Forest. Darren Rhodes, a member of the Rao River Fire Protection District's elected board, says the district has land set aside for its main Dorena hub. He says raising funds to build that station has become much more urgent. The district, which formed in 2024, is using fire trucks donated from other fire departments around Oregon. That equipment is stored outdoors on private property that's now up for sale after the owner decided to move to another state.
That situation has changed, so the urgency to get our main station up has moved forward in a timeline that we were unprepared for.
Kathleen Isidore is the executive director of Rao River Valley Community Partnership. The nonprofit supports fire prevention and emergency preparedness programs and is helping the fire district raise money for the project. She says she's hoping to fundraise across the wider region. The Rao River Valley is a bicycle destination, watershed, and a direct route to the Umpqua National Forest and historic Bohemia Mines.
This station will be the infrastructure that supports medical and fire emergencies throughout the valley, not only for the 500 homes, but for also the tens of thousands of people who travel through our area.
She says the fire district and supporters have asked Oregon's two U.S. senators and Representative Val Hoyle to champion their application for federal funding. If successful, the community would still need to come up with their share, about $1.5 million. Isidore says that'll be a challenge. She says a significant share of the community's small tax base is already struggling and can't afford a bond measure or higher property taxes.
If anyone can help, we ask for your assistance. This is an area well worth preserving, and the people who visit here, the people who live here, their safety is critical.
Isidore says the community has already started working with the county on permitting and other logistical hurdles and should be able to break ground quickly if it raises the funds. In Dorena, I'm Rebecca Hansen-White reporting.
Years after contracting COVID-19, Latino farm workers in Washington State are searching for answers as to why their health has not returned to normal. Spokane Public Radio's Monica Carrillo-Casas reports.
During the blueberry harvest in Oregon in 2021, Baldomero Munoz was working another long day in the fields when he started feeling dizzy. Munoz kept working, thinking it would pass, but the next day, he felt worse. A few days later, Munoz tested positive for COVID-19. The 75-year-old says even though it's been 5 years since his initial diagnosis, he continues to deal with symptoms on a daily basis.
To this date, my legs feel weak. I can't run anymore, and for about 3 seconds, I forget where I am.
Munoz believes he has long COVID. Researchers and physicians describe long COVID as a condition where the patient continues to feel lasting symptoms despite testing negative. In a study conducted by the University of Washington Latino Center for Health, about 41% of agricultural workers reported experiencing symptoms of long COVID. Leo Morales, one of the lead researchers, says it could be that many were late to access the vaccine.
There is a certain strain of skepticism and, I would say, misinformation that flows through the Latino community that, yeah, people are hesitant to do it. There's the vaccine will give you the disease. You know, that's one concern.
Munoz began picking strawberries in the Oregon fields in 1994 and then went back and forth between Oregon and Washington to pick grapes and blueberries. While the work is hard, he says his love for the fields has only grown. He says he often sings the day away during busy seasons. His commitment to the fields didn't change when he first got COVID. At the time, Munoz says he didn't realize how serious his symptoms were. He remembers thinking it was a cold creeping up on him. Or maybe he was working too quickly and it was causing him to feel dizzy. But after testing positive, Munoz realized he wasn't well enough to be on his own. So he drove to his daughter's house in Vancouver. A few days later, Munoz says he called her at work, feeling like he was on the verge of death.
She arrived and took me to the hospital, but I remember what hurt the most was my head. I felt like my head was about to explode, and little by little, my lungs felt like they were failing me.
He says he didn't work for several months due to pulmonary issues. Even now, he deals with lingering symptoms of weak muscles and respiratory problems. Farm workers Lorena Avalos and her husband Jose Leon tell of a similar experience. Leon says he was a healthy man who rarely got sick. Even during the first year of the pandemic, he says he didn't get COVID. He even got vaccinated. But 2 years ago, he contracted it and wound up in the hospital.
When I went to the hospital, they put a ventilator on me to help me breathe. I was given an inhaler afterward and use it 3 times a week, but I ended up in the hospital again a month later.
Leon says doctors diagnosed him with asthma, and later he developed pneumonia. The lasting effects, he says, have been brutal on his health.
I'm scared I'll end up in the hospital again, he says.
At their dining room table, his wife, Lorena Avalos, fidgets with an inhaler as she talks about testing positive for the virus 5 times. She has struggled with breathing problems since her first infection 4 years ago. The first time I got COVID was 3 months after getting the first vaccine. And then I tested positive again 5 months after. I was getting COVID every few months. Avalos and Leon now rely on inhalers to manage their lasting symptoms at a significant cost. Because the couple doesn't have health insurance, they pay out of pocket for every inhaler they buy, each about $120.
The minute I run out, I go and get another one.
Leon is also still paying his hospitalization bills. The Washington State Institute for Public Policies estimates at least 39% of farm workers don't have medical insurance. Last year, a bill was introduced in the legislature to address health coverage equity, recognizing that immigrants, including many farm workers, are disproportionately uninsured. The bill would have expanded access for people excluded from federal programs. But it didn't pass and it wasn't heard this year. If another pandemic comes around, there has to be a plan B. For now, workers like Munoz, Avalos, and Leon are left managing their symptoms on their own. I'm Monica Carrillo Casas, reporting.